This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Ronald Collins, the Harold S. Scheffelman Scholar at the University of Washington School of Law. Ron specializes in First Amendment law and in constitutional law. Before coming to the University of Washington in 2010, he was a scholar at the First Amendment Center in Washington, D.C. He clerked for Justice Hans A. Lind on the Oregon Supreme Court and was a Supreme Court Fellow under Chief Justice Warren Burger. Ron Collins is here today to tell us about his book, We Must Not Be Afraid to Be Free, Stories of Free Expression in America, co-authored with Sam Shaltane and published in 2011. Welcome, Ron.
Good to be here.
What was your purpose in writing your book, We Must Not Be Afraid to Be Free?
It begins when I'm a law student back in the 70s, and I read this case in my law school class, and there was a dissent in it by Justice Hugo Lafayette Black, and the dissent ended with a line, we must not be afraid to be free. And as a young man, those words just stuck in my mind, and it was almost as if I read it and it said, we must not be afraid to be free, exclamation point. And, you know, it rallied up an energy in me. And decades later, it proved to be the title of this book. And so, as Sam Cooke might have said, it's been a long time coming. But finally, it came. And the idea here in the book that I did with Sam Shaltane is to tell the stories of the people who were involved in some incredible free speech struggles. You know, when law is taught in law schools or colleges, so many times the life of the people that made our freedom possible is sucked out. You know, students learn facts and issues and rules, and then they move on to more facts and issues and rules. So the idea in this book was to tell the stories about the incredible people and their struggles to make our freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, to make those freedoms real. And so we thought we'd use a narrative style to do two things, to tell their life stories on the one hand, and on the other, to tell Americans generally a little bit about the law of freedom of speech in America.
Would you like to comment on the benefits of free speech?
Oh, where do I begin? You know, it's like, what are the benefits of oxygen? We couldn't live without it. I mean, it's our first freedom. I mean, if you go to the Bill of Rights, those five freedoms, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of petition, freedom of assembly, freedom of press. I mean, you cannot have a democracy without those freedoms. And at the point at which people aren't willing to speak freely and speak openly and to rejoice in that freedom, at that point, when they are not able to do those things, then we cease being a free people.
In our country, what have been seen as the dangers of free speech?
What are the dangers of freedom? You know, let me just back up a little bit. I mean, just speak personally, and then I'll just get to your question. For me, the safe life is not worth living. Now, I understand that's a bit provocative and it's a bit romantic, and I don't mind stepping on the sidelines and keeping the company of romantics. You know, when I see other people step back and an individual step forward to assert his freedom, it's something very moving for me, because I think we do depend on a small group of people, whether or not they're men in uniform, whether or not they're women in our service, whether or not they're government employees or private individuals or school teachers. We do depend on them sometime to take risks in the name of freedom. And there's all sorts of risks, national security, offending people, harm to children, you know, any number of things. Freedom has its prices. And the question is, are we as Americans willing, when our time comes, to pay that price?
In your book, you speak about First Amendment fundamentalism, or justices who have absolute faith in the First Amendment and others who believe that free speech should be balanced with societal needs. Would you give an overview of these two?
Yes. One of the heroes, I say heroes because sometimes he's a hero and sometimes he's not in the book, is Hugo Lafayette Black, a former member of the Supreme Court. Now, he died in 1971, former United States Senator, a man who was not without his faults. And he believed that the First Amendment was absolute, that government could never abridge freedom of speech. And so it didn't matter whether or not something was obscene or not. He didn't feel that you had to balance the individual interest in freedom against the societal interest in security. He just thought that we had to kind of ratchet it up and we had to suck it in. And If freedom sometimes bruised us, then so be it. We're all the stronger for it. Of course, on the other side, there were other people who said, well, this is suicidal. There are no absolutes in life. Everything is relative. Everything has to be balanced. And so they thought, on the one hand, you balance individual freedom against societal interests. Of course, too often, the thumb of the societal interest is heavier on the scales than that of the individual. So whether or not the individual is a person who's a Jehovah's Witness, who's standing out on the sidelines and whose religious beliefs offend others, and this was the case in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, you know, for Hugo Black, it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether or not their views offended others. Their rights were absolute, whereas for some other justices, you know, they'd have to balance it. I think really reality is somewhere in between. Nobody's absolutely absolute about anything. There are times in life where we all have to yield our freedom because sometimes freedom can be very dangerous. And we have to know at that point, I mean, for example, we all believe in freedom of the press. I mean, I think we do. We should. It's an important American freedom. But, you know, if there was a situation where the press, and it was clear, was going to divulge national secrets that would clearly, imminently, substantially interfere with the safety of our men and women in uniform abroad, then, of course, when you push freedom that far, it becomes suicidal.
Would you outline the different types of speech which have been defined by law and the extent to which they've been afforded protection?
I think in our country, political speech and religious speech are entitled to the most protection. So that's at one end of the spectrum. And political speech includes things like burning the American flag. I mean, that's symbolic expression. Political speech also sometimes in this country involves hate speech. Other countries, France, Germany, don't allow hate speech. We do. We think the answer is not to censor that speech, but to counter it. You know, more speech. So that's at one end of the spectrum. At the other end, there are certain types of freedom that we say as a society go too far. So I can't defame you. So I can't say hurtful things about you that are false and injure your reputation. I can't use speech to commit fraud or to commit a crime against you. So if I hired somebody and used words and said, I want you to commit this criminal act against Diane, certainly that kind of speech isn't protected. Those are the spectrums. And then, of course, in the middle is sometimes corporate speech. And we've seen that recently in the Citizens United case and about whether or not corporations can or can't spend their money in elections for electoral purposes.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Ronald Collins, the Harold S. Shuffleman Scholar at the University of Washington School of Law, and co-author with Sam Shaltain of the book We Must Not Be Afraid to Be Free, Stories of Free Expression in America. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you say a few words about the landmark First Amendment cases, if you were to pick two or three that were the most important in developing First Amendment thinking, which would you pick?
That's like asking a mother or father, which would you pick among your five children? Which are your favorite? You know, there are different ones for different reasons. Of course, I think the New York Times versus Sullivan, decided by the United States Supreme Court in 1964, written by the late Justice William Brennan, where the idea, there was a very important phrase that came from that case, speech on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open. I mean, those three words, just to kind of bring them together, are very important. I mean, one of the important cases was a case called Gitlow versus New York. And in that case, it was the first time that the First Amendment had been held applicable to the states. I mean, originally when the Constitution was drafted and the Bill of Rights were added to it, the First Amendment was only a restriction on the federal government. So it wasn't until 1925 that, by way of a judicial decision, it had become applicable to the state. So prior to 1925, if the state of Nebraska or Washington wanted to abridge my speech, the First Amendment didn't in any way pertain to them. So that's a rather important case. And every law student, I think, knows that case, Gitlow versus New York. But they don't know about the life story of Benjamin Gitlow, and that's something we talk about in the book.
Would you like to say a few words about that story?
Yeah, Benjamin Gitlow, what a man. Okay, put yourself around 1917, 1918, we're involved in a war. There's a lot of people who are opposed to the war. Woodrow Wilson comes into office, you know, he's going to get us out of war. And what does he do? He gets us knee deep in it. And a lot of people are very up in arms about that. And there's a lot of people who are leftists, communists, Marxists, socialists, anarchists. and they are very involved in their engagement. And that lasts from about 1917 all the way through the 20s. Benjamin Gitlow is one of those people, and he publishes something called the Left Wing Manifesto, which the court thought posed a clear and present danger to our national security. I tell you, the Left Wing Manifesto, the only thing the author of that would have to worry about is that somebody would assault him for writing something that was so terribly long and boring. But in any event, he's prosecuted, he's convicted. His case goes to the Supreme Court. He loses 7-2. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis dissent. Holmes writes an incredible dissent that would inspire freedom in people for decades to come. Benjamin Gitlow goes to jail. Sometime later, his wife comes to visit him. And during the visit, she gets a call. She takes the phone call, comes back, and informs the officers there that Benjamin Gitlow has just been pardoned. He goes to the train station. He's surrounded by all of his socialists and Marxist friends. And he says, it's the proletariat today, the proletariat tomorrow, the proletariat forever. A few years later, he's involved in a fight with Stalin. He's thrown out of the Communist Party. He becomes thereafter a secret agent for the FBI. He testifies at the House on Un-American Activities Committee. He claims that 600, I believe, Methodists were communists, and that Stephen Weiss, the renowned rabbi, is also communist. He dies, and when he dies, the only people that have anything nice to say about this leftist is the National Review magazine, Benjamin Gitlow.
Are there additional landmark decisions you'd like to mention?
Well, there's a landmark case, NAACP versus Alabama, which basically created the right of freedom of association as we know it. And it was argued by a remarkable man named Robert Carter. We all know the name Thurgood Marshall, the man who argued Brown versus Board, became a Supreme Court justice. But not many people, not even people in law, know the name Robert Carter. Robert Carter was an incredible American, African-American. He worked with Thurgood Marshall. He went to Howard Law School. And then almost single-handedly saved the NAACP when Alabama and other states wanted a list of all of their names, their membership. He refused to turn over those lists and argued not one, not two, not five, but eight cases, First Amendment cases in the Supreme Court, won them all, changed the landscape of American First Amendment law. And without Robert L. Carter, I wonder if the NAACP could have continued to do the marvelous work that it did. That's his story.
How has the First Amendment interpretation changed over time?
Prior to 1919 in Justice Holmes, in terms of the courts and their respect for the First Amendment, it was virtually non-existent. Things start to change by way of ideas, not the law, but people like Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis and a few others, they start to plant the seeds of freedom and the ideas and get us to try to think about a whole new way of thinking about freedom. That picks up a little bit in the 30s. Then we come into the McCarthy era and it kind of moves back and our freedoms begin to recede. And then into the late 50s and into the 60s, Earl Warren, Hugo Black, William O. Douglas from Washington State here, I believe it was Yakima, and William Brennan begin to usher in a new day. And basically since then, First Amendment freedoms have become a staple of our liberty here in America. And I dare say, with all our problems in this country, the measure of freedom we grant under the First Amendment, I dare say, is more than any place else in the world or in the history of humankind.
Would you say more about First Amendment rights and hate speech? Does the First Amendment protect hate speech, and to what extent?
Well, it does. Let me give you an example. There are some people who believe that they're called by God to protest at the funerals of our fallen men and women who serve this country. And I don't know what kind of religious belief prompts anyone to do anything that despicable. But having said that, I'm certainly willing to defend their rights up to a point, up to a point. So they can't trespass. They can't threaten somebody. They can't directly harm somebody. But if they decide in their, in my view, crazed views of their worship that they want to be a block away and hold signs and demonstrate, then that's their right, and the Supreme Court recently, in a vote of 8-1, agreed. Is that egregious? Absolutely. Is it offensive? Absolutely. But that's part of the price that we pay for a robust freedom. I'll give you one example. This family decided, at least there were news reports that they had decided, that they were going to protest at the funeral of this young woman who had been assassinated in Arizona. Can you imagine? I mean, what kind of mind does it take to go with this, if you will, message from God and protest that at a scene like that? And here's Here's the wonderful First Amendment moment. A young teenager got the idea that the idea is not to shut down this speech, but to counter it, all right, to bring freedom, to bring a different perspective in. And what did she do? She got some sheets and created angel's wings and held her arms out. And along with a number of other people, first 10, then 20, then 50, then 100, and then it went on the internet, and there were thousands of people. And they were going to have a circle around the funeral procession so the Phelps' message couldn't be seen, the family message couldn't be seen. And guess what? It worked. And so to me, there you have hate speech, and there you have it countered. We allow it in this country, and we think the best way to fight it is to counter it. Other countries have different views, and I don't want to say ours is necessarily better than theirs, but it's ours, and I feel comfortable with it.
Would you comment also on racial slurs?
Sure. If Americans decide whether or not they say it for racial purposes, or it be a rapper like Lil Wayne to say the N-word, they're allowed to. We're allowed to say it. I certainly wouldn't counsel it. I certainly wouldn't advise people. To be honest with you, I'm 61, and when I hear some of these young rappers that my son listens to, and they use that word, it jolts me every time I hear it, because I can remember the harm, at least in a general sense, that that did to people. But again, freedom is risky business. When it comes right down to it, I think Nat Hentoff once said, free speech for me, but not for thee, you know. And we must not be afraid to be free. What Sam and I try to do is, on the one hand, chart out the realm of freedom, on the other hand, chart out the realm of fear. And our lives move back and forth between those two. And there are times when we definitely should fear freedom. The costs are just too great. But there are other times when it is risky, and Americans have sacrificed their liberty, have sacrificed their well-being, have sometimes even sacrificed their lives to defend our freedom. And I think we let the reader decide where he or she wants to move, but I think it's something that should be at the forefront of our minds.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Ronald Collins, the Harold S. Shuffleman Scholar at the University of Washington School of Law, and co-author with Sam Chaltain of the book We Must Not Be Afraid to Be Free, Stories of Free Expression in America. Would you comment on free speech and radio?
Are you sure you want to go there?
Of course.
Okay. There's a law that says indecent speech cannot be aired on broadcast radio or television. Cable is different. Internet is different. So there's those seven dirty words that George Carlin used to talk about, the late George Carlin, the comedian, cannot be said on broadcast radio or television. Again, I said cable is different. Internet is different. All those other things are different. So the 50th anniversary of the publication of the incredible poem Howl by Allen Ginsberg comes up, and some of us get together and we want to see if Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the owner of City Lights Bookstore, an incredible American poet, a man who published Howl and who in 1957 was prosecuted for obscenity for publishing Howl. And you know, Diane, what he did when he was prosecuted? He wrote an op-ed and went after the prosecutor, and then he ordered the people in his bookstore to fill the windows of City Lights Books with copies of Howl. He just stood up, and if it meant going to jail, he said, I will just read more poetry. I'll have more time to read poetry. So now move forward 50 years, and we ask him if he's willing to read Howl on the radio, on public radio. And he says, yes, of course. Public radio thinks we could lose our license, we could be fined out of existence. I got together with a group of First Amendment lawyers and said, we've got your back. We'll represent you. Some of the finest First Amendment lawyers in the country. They almost did it. They almost did it. You know, it's fine for us to be righteous with their radio license. It's a little different for them. We said, look, we want you to do the same thing that Lawrence Ferlinghetti did in 1957. We struck a compromise. We did it on internet radio. But I look forward to the day, and I predict that within 3 years, Howl will be read legally on the radio thanks to the First Amendment.
To what extent has political context affected First Amendment interpretation?
Context makes all the difference in the world. As the late Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, you can't yell fire in a theater, right? I mean, there's certain things that you can't do in certain places. So we have what are called time, place, and manner regulations. So, for example, although if you want, and it's hate speech, you can burn a cross in the middle of a field and you're protected, assuming you don't create a fire. You can't take a burning cross and place it on somebody's front yard, right? One is freedom, the other is a threat. So the context makes all of the difference in the world, whether or not you say something in a park, or whether or not you say it on a radio station, whether or not you say it in a theater. I mean, it makes all the difference in the world where the speech takes place. Context is important.
Would you say more about the clear and present danger test?
Yes, clear and present danger. Well, basically, it involves usually typically matters of national security. So you remember the Pentagon Papers case. You know, there's some classified public documents, the New York Times, the Washington Post, other papers get copies, and they want to run it. These involve, at the time, matters that affected the war in Vietnam. And the New York Times and the Washington Post and others decided that there was a portion of those papers they were going to publish. The government went to court to prevent them, said, you can't do that. This involves national security. Now, the law is that in that situation, unless something poses a clear or an imminent danger, that means it's about to happen and it has to be substantial, all right, which is a very hard burden to meet, then it's to be protected. But if you think about that, some people would say, well, at the point at which the danger is clear or imminent and substantial, it might be too late. So you can see right there where there's a risk involved, a great risk. But we've decided to err on the side of freedom. Justice Holmes once said, law, like life, is an experiment. And sometimes experiments fail. But so far, the experiment of the First Amendment in this country has prevailed. And so now we may not have the Pentagon Papers case, but we have WikiLeaks. And so it's, you know, it's the same issue kind of rearing its head up again and again.
Would you comment also on the fighting words doctrine?
Yeah, fighting words doctrine, contrary to what most people think, is just about dead. I mean, I think it exists as a black letter law, but for all practical purposes, it's virtually dead. Basically, the doctrine was is that if I'm speaking to you, you've seen all fighting words. Usually when two guys get together, particularly in a bar, and words start flying back and forth, and, you know, they're right on the verge of a fight. So that's where the idea came up. So if you think of the guys in the bar that have had a little too much to drink and their words start flying and what have you, and you just think, oh, any moment now, any moment, the fists are going to start flying. So that was the original purpose of the doctrine. And it basically said if they're fighting words, then they're not protected by the First Amendment. But what happened was is that a lot of times they were used to counter political speech. So if somebody yelled out to a policeman in a demonstration, you fascist pig, all right, they were arrested for fighting words. And because of that, with the passage of time, the doctrine has lost a lot of its currency.
Would you comment also on prior restraint?
Prior restraint. Okay, well, it has mainly to do, not exclusively, with the freedom of the press, which includes radio stations. So let us say that your radio station decided in its wisdom that it was going to say certain things about somebody that might be defamatory. Let's say you thought, you and your colleagues thought they weren't defamatory, but somebody else thought they were. And you do the radio show on a particular day, but it's not going to air for, say, 2 or 3 weeks. Some party finds out that indeed they've got a secret copy of the tape or whatever it is you've made. And so they go to court and they say, Diane and her colleagues, they're about to defame us. Here, you can listen to it. And we want you, the judge, to issue an order preventing them from airing. Well, the doctrine of prior restraint says can't do that, all right, that you can air the show. And so that's a very important freedom. Now, it may be that after you air the show, you could be sued for libel or something like that. But prior restraint says that freedom of the press means that at least at that opening salvo, you have the right to air those views, and a court cannot restrain you. And there are very few exceptions to prior restraint. I mean, there are some. I won't go into them. They're a bit technical. But it's a very important freedom, and it dates back centuries, and it is really a core staple of freedom of the press in this country.
And what are some important examples of where prior restraint has come in as an issue?
Well, for example, there was a case out of Nebraska where a judge said to a local newspaper that wanted to cover a murder trial, while the trial was going on, you, the paper, can't write about it. Well, it's the classic prior restraint. Now, is it possible that the paper could write things that might influence members of the jury? Is that possible? I mean, steps could be taken to prevent that, but sure, that's possible. Is it possible that the paper might write things that may make it harder for a defendant to get a fair trial? Yeah, that's true. But again, the doctrine of prior restraint says a judge cannot stop the printing presses or the airwaves from going ahead and delivering their messages.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I don't have any grand ideas about changing the landscape of the American mind or anything like that. I'd be happy if a half century from now, when the printed page has perhaps become passé, that some young man or woman would find themselves in a library where they probably had to go out of their way to get to, where they actually had these old things on shelves called books, and opened it and read a page or two, and it sparked something in their imagination. I think a poet, I forget which poet, once said, "The dead live on the lips of the living." And what we try to do in We Must Not Be Afraid to Be Free is to bring some of those dead Americans who made incredible contributions to our freedom, to bring them back alive. And so when I speak, that's the attempt. When we write about it, that's what it's about. And perhaps someday, a half century from now, maybe a young man or woman will pick it up and it'll spark something in their mind, in their heart, about the importance of freedom of speech and freedom of press.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, there's a number of messages. Be careful what you wish for. I mean, you know, because freedom is risky business. I mean, I mentioned that when I was a young man, I read We Must Not Be Afraid to Be Free as if it had an exclamation point. As I get older and I become more concerned about security, I read it as We Must Not Be Afraid to Be Free question. So thank God for young people, because they bring a vibrant measure of not only recklessness, and of course there is that, you can be young and reckless, but also a certain vibrant feeling for freedom. And for those over 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, as in my case, try to save a little spark of that youth in your heart. And for the younger people, I would say two things. One, keep freedom alive. And two, be careful. Be careful. So again, as I say in the book, Sam and I, we try not to tell people this is what you must do. We are speaking from on high. I think in one respect or another, all of us at one point, we need to look up to people. We need to have people that we can aspire to do in our own humble way what they did. And so these are some stories about some of those Americans, about a dozen of them. And so my message, I guess, to people is, as I said, on the one hand, be careful what you wish for. On the other hand, never stop wishing.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Ron.
It's been fun. Thank you.
You have just been listening to Ronald Collins, the Harold F. Shuffleman Scholar at the University of Washington School of Law and co-author with Sam Chaltain of the book We Must Not Be Afraid to Be Free, Stories of Free Expression in America, published in 2011 by Oxford University Press. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.